Hey everybody, you're in for a treat today. I've interviewed the one and only Wayne Cavanaugh. Wayne has done everything you can possibly do in the sport of dogs. I don't want to go through the list because it's like naming off all Tiger Woods' wins and it would go on endlessly. But let's just say, when I grow up, I want to be Wayne Cavanaugh.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Will Alexander, again. I'm here with one of my favorites of all time, my big brother, Wayne Cavanaugh. And I don't want to list Wayne's achievements because it's like listing the wins of Tiger Woods. So we're going to go away from that, and we'll just get into all those things, I'm sure. How are you, Wayne?
I'm doing well, thank you.
It's great to see you. Hey, guys, how are you guys doing there in Kalamazoo? How's Cheryl?
Cheryl's doing well. Kids are doing great. And I have to say up front, I may get photobombed by my buddy here, Killian, who knows no better but to be in the picture.
So. Oh, that's excellent. It's all about dogs anyway, so
that's right.
What we're here for. Okay, I'm going to start from the very beginning. You're a third-generation dog person, so obviously you got involved with dogs from your father and your mother. Can you explain that a bit for me?
Yeah, it was, you know, like all of us good Irishmen, my grandparents emigrated. My grandpa came over. I never met him. He came over with Kerry Blues and then picked up a chow or two, his house pets. And he loved those dogs. The pictures I have of them, they're old working class dogs, but he'd get in the occasional show of them. And my father got the bug and he started with Beagles and then English Setter. Yeah, his first dogs were Beagles and then English Setter. So my first Beagle was a red and white named Cookie. And I've always had a fondness for red and whites ever since. But, so that started very early in my life. I was 8 when I finished my first Beagle. As I mentioned before, it wasn't about talent. I got under 3 good judges that were all, you know, taken care of back in the day. And we finished pretty quick. But he was a good one though. And then after that, when I started to get older, I got more into the English Setters because they had more, you know, more flair for, junior showmanship.
Oh, of course.
And I was, you know, very interested in that. Although I really rather show in the breed classes. That was more fun to me as well. But it was a good crew. We had a lot of people in those juniors classes that you know today. And then as I got older, I always had a fancy for pointers. And I was at Ralph Del Deo's house, one of my great early mentors that people may not remember, but he was a super dog man and a great guy. And he said, you know, you should have a pointer. I've always liked them. So he gave me a bitch that he bred that was sired by Davian Mithridates, who was an English import from Bill and Hilda Parkinson. And the Davian line is very different. They're very liver, big patches of liver. Mm-hmm. And they were doing a lot of winning at the time in England. The Crook Rise dogs were completely different. But I got this nice bitch from Ralph and went best of winners at her first show at the National. And we did pretty well there after that. And I was hooked, but I was also starting to work for Bob and Jane at the time. And once I got to Gray Arlen, I saw Crook Rise Suki and Crook Rise Greg and asked the Forsythes if I could write that lady a letter. And that was the Crook Rise, amazing Crook Rise legend, Cicely Robertshaw and her mom, Kitty Edmondson. And they were so kind and they sent me a really nice pointer who I won the National with in 1980. That was Miles, Rosanar Macchiato of Crook Rise. Miles had just a special spot for me, and we had a really good time and did some nice winning and some nice hanging out. He was just a good guy.
Yeah.
Then after that, I poured a couple more from England, and we had a good thing going for many, many years.
So you mentioned Bob and Jane. Would you consider them like your first dog show mentors other than your father and mother?
Well, I think Ralph Dodea was in there, but for a longer period of time, it was Bob and Jane. I went to work there right out of high school.
What was that like? I can imagine. That'd be so exciting. Right.
And then I went back and forth. I tell Bob I need to go back to school for a while, to college for a while. And then I come back. But it was extraordinary. I don't think, and not to sound like the million-year-old man, but I don't think some of the assistants today will ever get that education. I mean, first of all, we had 100 dogs, and they weren't just dogs. They were the best ones of every breed. And it's almost cheating when you get to grow up with every single breed, trimming them, bathing them, learning about their presentation, learning about their history. I mean, it was just a PhD in dogs, and many of us took great advantage of it. It's quite a list. But it was $100 a week, and they got me this house, this room to live in nearby. And there were two nurses upstairs, and I was a real young kid. I was 18. I was downstairs. And the only bathroom was upstairs. So I was terrified. If the nurses were home, I just wouldn't go up there no matter what. And we ended up having a really good time there. I got arrested once, or potentially arrested, for trying to break in because I lost my keys. Bob had to take care of that. But it was really a fun time, and it was hard work. You know, you worked 7 days a week. On your day off, you're expected to go to the airport with Janie and pick up some dogs or drop off dogs, but you didn't want to not be there.
Sure.
You wanted to be there at all times.
Who were some of the other kids working there when you were there?
Kathy Kirk was there. She was running the show. And we had a lot of people come and go. Mark and Bonnie occasionally, and they were just amazing to work with. But that wasn't full time. I wasn't there full time when they were there. Hillary Six, Finn. There was a bunch of people that came and went when I was there. But on the weekends after, even after I left, and you probably heard this, but you never leave. You never leave. You're always working for Bob and Jane. I still believe, even with them, God bless them, long gone, I still believe I'm working for them all the time. And you would work on weekends for them when you could, when I was in school. And that's where we really got the super crews together. That's when we got everybody to work together. And man, we were shuttling so many dogs. Kathy's job, primary job, was to run the rings and use a photographer, call Billy Gilbert and say, hey, take a bunch of pictures so we can delay this ring so Janie can get here. We had the whole thing. I mean, it was like choreography to a ballet. And there were some clients who wanted me to cover their dogs because they knew they weren't going to get Bob and Jane. It would be a class dog. And some that wanted somebody else. And so that whole thing had to be just so well tied together and so well pitched to make it run. We'd often win all six groups back when they were six. So then you had to go find handlers for the others.
And no one would turn down Bob and Jane. So.
No one turned them down, even if they knew they were going to get bit. You know, it wasn't a problem. They take their chances. We had a beagle that my dad bred. Bob was tired of getting beat by him. So he bought him for Mrs. Lowe and Mildred Lowe from Validate Kennels in California, who was a lovely, lovely lady. And so I was working around the weekends, and Bob was showing Charlie. His name was Harold's Prince Charles. And he liked me. He liked Bob. And he liked me. And he liked Bob. He didn't even like Janie much. But Bob thought it was funny to get the cocker handlers to cover them. Because, first of all, they're really good with small dogs. They can do the kneel-down thing. And really, cockers and terriers and beagles have got, you know, there's a lot there to work from if you're used to one transition. But he got Teddy once, who was a dear friend. I miss him terribly. To cover Charlie, and didn't take 2 seconds for Charlie to bite him and take off around the group ring. And,
nice.
And Bob had the Afghan because Jeannie had something else. She usually showed Desert Wind, but it was back in that era. And I always called him the duty to run into the ring and chase the spear. And then Bob's like, give it back to him. Like, no, we're not going there. I'll take him from here. And I wasn't very old then. I just had started working with him. I wasn't working there yet. So it was quite the leap. But we had so many great times, so many fun times, and so many stories. Well, Mark is great at telling a boatload of them.
I bet.
And there's plenty of them. Our biggest challenge working there, and you can ask anybody who worked there, was, two things. One, if you got back in that bus without toilet paper, and I think of her now and today of the rare toilet paper, right?
Yeah.
She would have been covered because you had to steal the toilet paper from the room, and then we'd store it in this big closet at Gray Arlen. She should never have had to buy any. A lot of it had like wood chips in it and single ply, but she didn't care. She'd never let anybody buy it. So we had plenty of that cover, but the big thing was picking your roommate because you were going to get stuck with a handler. You had to pick your handler. And Fats, Bobby Fowler, who they, you know, lovingly called Fats, he was a great roommate, but he snored like a freight train. So you had to try to, you know, you like him, you want to be around him, but sharing a room was, you know, you weren't going to get up the rest of the morning. You wanted to find those guys, and I'm not going to name any names, who, let's say, didn't always stay in their room at night. You know?
Okay.
They had a wandering soul. I'm sure they were out meditating in the woods or something.
Planning their
those next are the day. Guys. That's right. Those are the guys you wanted to room with because you had the whole room to yourself. So, yeah, there was lots of little machinations to make it all work, but they will never be another place like it. Never.
I'm sure of that. It's part of our history, and I always think that if you look back at a handler's pedigrees today, you go right to the top, there's going to be Bob and Jane there. It influenced most of us. So. Yep.
There was an ad once they published in Kennel Review, and it was really nice of them to do, just listing all the people that worked for them and what they had gone to do in the dog show world in many avenues. I went to the AKC after that, and there are plenty of people who made transitions to handling and others that found other ways in the sport. And it was really quite a golden era.
I bet, yeah. We don't really have that kind of personalities anymore that empowering, really.
And I know when you and Luke were talking about your special leads and all that. And that, by the way, that was great. And Luke was spectacular.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy.
But I was cleaning out my old tack box, which in itself is a story. And I found four Rescos, wide whites, and one black wide white.
I love the wide ones. They're my favorite.
And that was the only thing we had. You know, it was easy. What do they come up on? Are they, you know, is it a brown, black, or white? Because wide Resco, because that's all you had. That's all you needed. We didn't have a train. We didn't need those darn leashes you kids use today. You whippersnappers with your chains under the air.
Having all the bling on them.
But, it was a different time. I remember during that time, I started working for Animal Planet. My first interview was George Ward. And whenever I feel old, I think about this. I asked him, the first question I asked him was, what was the biggest difference between dog shows when you started and what we have today?
Uh-oh.
He didn't miss a beat. He said, electricity. And really, they didn't have blow dryers. They didn't have drops. They had hand clippers for a while, you know?
I had a pair of those when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. And they took trains to the shows. So when they were going to Philadelphia, they'd rent these trains or arrange for the seats to be taken out. And you'd have all the handlers from all over the country that could make it to the big shows in Philly.
Wow.
All stacked crates on the train. And, Henry Stecker was another big mentor for me. He was just brilliant. He lived close by and took me under his wing early and told me some amazing stories about going to the airport. The harbor. Going to the docks in New York to pick up a poodle or a boxer that he imported. And back then, we take this so much for granted. He had a Model A or a Model T or a car like that. And we lived an hour from New York. Getting to New York took all day. And you had to bring a few extra tires and wheels because they were going to break. You weren't going to make it all the way there and back. Now, this isn't as old as Doug Belter's stories. This is Henry Stecker. This is way before my time. This is back when Doug and Henry were hanging out. Maybe that was a little, I don't know. But anyway, those guys really, it was a different challenge for them. You know, it was a whole different world. And I'm really fortunate to have been exposed to all ends of it, you know, to watching you these days and back with the Forsythes and the stories from Henry Stecker and George Ward and those guys. It was just
an amazing character. George grew up just down the road from where I lived in Oakville.
Yeah.
He went to Milton and he used to drive he told me stories about driving his bike by my eventual house to go fishing. Yeah. I just thought that was amazing. You could always drive by the highway up until about, I guess, 15, 20 years ago. You would see his dad's old kennel from the highway.
Yeah. He was a bicycle racer. You know, he did, there's great pictures. Well, you saw him at the kennel, at George's kennel, which is near me. Again, now I'm only 45 minutes from the kennel, not even. But George liked to go to hockey games and he liked to have me pay. So he would say, hey, you got any tickets? And then He'd invite his friend. He had a friend down there. I forget his name. He was a non-dog guy. They'd come up to Kalamazoo for hockey games, and he'd always come early and then say, maybe we should grab a bite. And that meant I had to buy him dinner. But he wore earplugs to the games. He hated that damn music they played. Yeah. He wanted organ music. Just a great guy.
George, my memory of George is going to shows in Michigan, and no matter how early you got there, George was always the first.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if I came in at 6:02, he'd say, good afternoon, Mr. Alexander. One time I remember walking at 6:05, and he walked over to my setup, and he said, do you ever miss a dog show entirely?
You know, I don't think people realize how funny George could be.
Oh, no, he was great.
I mean, he was just, he was hysterical. And so the knowledge from these guys, you know, and by the way, another mentor for me was Tom Bradley, who's a dear friend still. And I wouldn't say Tom was, his, I mean, he certainly was a dog mentor, but what Tom taught me about life is something I'll never forget.
Yeah.
Tell me about how to interact with people, how to go, when I was 18 and green, how to go to dinner with people of substance, and how to dress, and just simple little things. How to talk to a person who maybe had a bone to pick with you. Or he's just, he'll always be that guy that, he was always there. Still is.
People don't understand how important those aspects are, because where we are in a people-related industry, and you need to be able to talk to anybody. And those skills are, you know, very important.
And I learned about life from Bob and Jane as well. You know, I don't know how it works today, because I am 200 years old. But back in the day, when we were working for a handler, you went for Bob and Jane. You were expected to somehow, miraculously, turn the dogs out, give them dinner, and show up at the restaurant looking good and talking to the clients when you were supposed to, and how that all worked to become a gentleman in the sport. I remember the first time I went to dinner with him. It was the Clementis, who I adored. And you know, Bob was a big, tough guy, and I was 18, and I probably weighed 120 pounds. You know, and I walked into this restaurant. I sat down, and Bob says, and I just turned 18, so it was drinking age, right? So very little experience in such matters. And Bob said, Dewar's on the rocks. And I said, yeah, I'll have one of those too. And I had to drink the whole thing. It was like kerosene. I couldn't believe it. I had never touched this stuff. And I was like, oh. And then I finish it, and what does Forsyth do? He knows what's going on. Give the kid another one. I'm all, geez, you better finish it. Oh, it was torture. But you learned a whole lot from those people about dogs, too, in life. And you had the opportunity to trim and bathe and scrape and breed whelp puppies. You know, we had the Farrell's Smooths there then. So we were whelping Smooth Fox Terrier puppies and patching them back together when they got into puppy arguments. And, you know, working with every breed you can imagine. I showed Commodores there for a Commodore for Michael somebody who had a Citroen, I forget his name, from Brooklyn or Bronx or something. But Jane didn't want to show the thing. Who the hell wanted to show the But I did. And he was another one. He would bite the judge when he went around the hunt court. So Bob told me, just step on his foot when they get back there and say it was your fault. So that's what we did. That's how I showed him. Boy, little bugger got his toe stepped on every time. gently.
What do you think is your biggest accomplishment in dogs thus far?
You know, I've had so many great opportunities. I've had so many great opportunities in different aspects of the sport. Working at the AKC as vice president of communications, I was able to do a lot of things that I'd like to think have a lasting impact. I had Terry Stacy and John Mandeville as my cohorts, and together we got some really important things done, including Canine Health. John and I were charter board members of the Canine Health Foundation when it just started. And I still feel strong about Canine Health today, and I'm so proud of what our breed clubs have done, not just in health, but in temperament and encouraging testing and so many things that were long overdue. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I also served on the pet population study for population of, this is the longest title in the world, population study in California with dog show people, some hardcore dog breeders, also animal rights people. We sat in the same room and decided that we were going to set all our differences aside to work on the shelter problem. And we were euthanizing 10 million dogs a year back then. It's 30 years ago. And now we're down to under a million, and who knows if any of those are even adoptable. It's gotten way better. I mean, certainly some of them, many of them are, but we're not talking about 10 million euthanasias anymore. So that felt pretty good. Taking the UKC over from Fred Miller and running that for 15 years, I'd like to think we changed things there and a lot of new programs. You know, we started the thing, Connie Miller started the Total Dog thing. Then Mark and I took it to the next level. We would invite the dogs who had competed in performance events and won their breed into this big ring before the groups and congratulate them all. I'd shake everyone in their hands, we'd give them ribbons for doing both in one day. Then we decided if they got a qualifying score in any of our performance events and won their breed, there would be a total dog group. Well, we brought them all in. The first time was spontaneous. They were in the group for the ribbons. And I said to Mark, let's judge it. Let's have a dog show. So right on the, just like you can do at AKC, right? So right on the spot, we held a competition for best in show. And the next year we made it groups, and there was a few in each group. And eventually they became really large groups of people who, it was just so heartwarming to see these people who work so hard. We had one in St. Louis where a nice springer just got out of dock jumping, you know, our diving competition, and came running in for the breed soaking wet. And she's in tears. What do I do? I said, what do you do? You show him. So she toweled him off as best she could and went in soaking wet and won the breed. We created a different world there. And I'd like to hope it's going to continue. But
that was amazing. I judged there one year for you and I watched that total dog. And afterwards, they all stand up and there was like a standing ovation for the UKC. They were so thrilled with what you guys had done for them. It was amazing to watch.
There's one picture that I cherish. Valerie Piltz from California had a great American Pit Bull Terrier. And one year I gave it best total dog. And we knew it was coming because she's Valerie. She ran out to get the ribbon, picked me up, and swung me around like a rag doll. It wouldn't put me down. And people would do the wave. They would do the wave at ringside. It was really fun. But and we got some important health things done there too, which Fred was the first one to use DNA before me.
Wow.
And we actually ran the DNA. We didn't just collect it and store it. So that was good. I've had some great wins and had some very good luck breeding, and that was a lot of fun, of course. But I'd like to think that, I had a long career in television too. And
you did, you know.
And this is the first time I've been on camera without makeup and hair and lights. So, you know, I don't look this old. If the makeup guys are, I'd be 18. Yeah. But it was really fun. We learned a lot because you had to interact with judges and breeders and handlers. You had to get the scoop that everybody, I wanted to learn about the dogs and the breeds. I didn't care if their favorite treat was a hot dog. I didn't care what their, 15 favorite names were. I wanted to know about what that breed meant to them. And when I finally started doing the commentary for Crufts for the BBC, I met Frank Kane, who's become a wonderful lifetime friend. I've been doing TV for a while, and Frank was new at it. But he was so exuberant and so interested and passionate that his commentary came through. And we never used notes. Frank and I would do the 10 billion breeds they have over there off the top of our head. And
that's amazing.
It was more fun that way. And we could have some, the BBC likes a little, they don't mind a little conversation with a little spice. And we're talking German Shepherds one day, and Frank was raving about this German Shepherd who, in my mind, was, we certainly didn't have the top line that I'm used to. And we agreed to disagree, and I said, you know, Frank, we're going to have to end this. It's just like, you know, I'm a little bit country. You're a little bit rock and roll. And we're all live back then. So it was all good. We had a great time doing it. And Jessica Holm and Peter Purvis. I mean, you're working with real pros and, you know, Shakespearean actors. I mean, people that had such talent. And we learned a lot.
There you go, me.
Yeah, that's right. And we learned so much from each other. You know, we really did. And it was a great experience as well. So, so many different facets for me that came together. And then writing as well. You know, writing's been fun too. You know, I've enjoyed that.
Writing, yeah.
My first Winky was in 92, maybe. Yeah, I think it was 92 for Outstanding Journalist. Back when Winkies were big statues. And my second Winky was for Best Hound, Show Dog of the Year, that Mr. Wonderful Will Alexander showed for us, Miss P. And that's slightly smaller than the 92. And now I hear you get like a rosette and a pack of Chiclets or something. I'm not sure what you get now. But
it's not, in the background on your mantelpiece. So.
Are they back? Oh, yeah.
One is taller than the other. So the one on the on my left must be mine because it's shorter than that one.
That's true. The best part of that, the first one, is I didn't think I was going to win. I was writing for Dog News. And I've been doing a weekly column forever there. And I didn't, you know, there were some heavy writers. And I didn't think I was going to win. So Noreen Baxter from our department went out to the award ceremony, which is in California then, and accepted on my behalf. And she kind of had an Annie Hall kind of thing going on. And when she went through the airport, they made her take out this metal object. Of course, everyone thought it was an Oscar. And there was it was a good experience for her. Yeah,
she's got good service.
Yeah. That's good service.
So you've done all this. You've done showing dogs, breeding dogs, working in kennel clubs, TV. You must have some superstitions before you do all these things. What superstitions do you have, Wayne?
Well, you know, I'm not that superstitious a guy, but, and I hate to even reveal this because it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a world-class secret because it's 100, you know, some people say, well, I change the tie when I start to lose. This has never, ever failed me. And I probably shouldn't reveal his name, but there's a handler, a friend of ours that, you know, he's just a great guy. And he has a tendency to doze off. He's an older guy, you know, to doze off at a show, be it ringside or at the setup. And I've always played this carefully, so he doesn't even know I've done it for years. But he doesn't have a lot of hair on top of his head, you see. So if you could get his baseball cap off and just rub his head gently so he didn't wake him up, but get that, you know, rub his head a little bit, I couldn't lose. And you could even store him up. So before the garden with Miss P, I started in December. And I, because I didn't show anything at all. I didn't even go in a ring from December to February because I wanted to store up this head energy. So I'd rub his head and I had about five or six in the bank, you know? And then of course, when the garden came all the way through to Best in Show, and it was an incredible thing. And I wouldn't want to reveal his name, but his initials are Doug Belter. So I wouldn't want to tell anybody his name because everybody's going to be rubbing his head now. I don't think that would, you know, it'd slow down his performance. So, but I, you know, that's, it's worked every time for me. You can't beat it. I would recommend it to just about.
That makes him part of the campaign then.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I would certainly, he was part of the campaign and I'll never, you know, I'm forever grateful to him. But if you're out there and you need that edge, that's what I try. It works for me. Works.
What
love you, Dougie.
What famous dog of the past, not of your own, that you saw or witnessed, would you wish were your own dog?
It's easily Mick, the Gary Blue. Yeah, it's easy for me. I saw him with Crufts, and you know the cool thing about Crufts is it's so big that Frank and I, we did a Wayne and Kane show separate for the BBC, and we run through the aisles and do what we could to talk to people and do sidebar interviews. So I didn't see him that day. I'd never see him. He was shown, was it Jeff Corse that showed him over there?
I believe so, yeah.
Somebody good. And I remember being up in the booth, you're elevated quite a bit over the group ring, and you're standing there with your microphones, and And all of a sudden this dog walks in the ring, and I almost came to tears. It was just, I never saw anything like it. He was not only spectacular, breed type, everything, but he was also just had it. And I don't like the dogs when they just have it because they had it, but he was that good and had it. Yeah. And then when Bill McFadden got him, and I got to see him over here, and didn't he win? I think he won the Garden in Morris and Essex. Who's going to ever do that again? Crufts the Garden in Morris. It was an extraordinary thing to see. And I have a fondness for Kerry Blues, but I'd have him right there, you know. And of course, Miss P. But yeah, that could be, there could be a little bias.
It is yours. That's along the same line, but more of a person wise, what person of the past you wish you could bring back and talk to?
Billy Kendrick.
Billy Kendrick?
Yeah. I was a young kid, but I did have a couple conversations with him because I was, you know, working for handlers, and I hadn't even thought of this until now, but I know you've got a great Bouvier pet, so I was thinking about this, and we were up on some New England circuit. We stayed in these flea bag hotels, and Roy had one, had a Bouvier, of course. And I forget who the other one was, but someone else had a good Bouvier. I'm not sure it was George, but it was someone like that. And Roy had won. And I wish I could remember. I think it was George. And we came back to the hotel. We were sitting in the hotel room after just talking, and Roy was there, and George was there, and Billy walked.
Alston, is that what we're talking about?
No, Ward.
Oh, George Ward had a Bouvier.
It's a long time ago. It's a long time ago. I was probably 17, 18. And Billy Kendrick walks by, and they said, hey, come here, we want to talk about this. Yeah, no, it was Forsythe. It was Forsythe who had the Bouvier, not George. We want to talk about this. How come, you know, I won, and you didn't? You know, you didn't put Forsythe, or Forsythe was pissed he didn't win or something. So Kendrick said, well, let's go through it point by point. And there was dust all over the TV. So he took his finger and he wet it a little bit, and he went, all right, yours had a better head. And he put a line. I liked your front better. And this went on for a whole lot of hash marks. And Roy said, what about moving? You know, who moved better? My dog was way better on his legs. And Billy said, I didn't really watch him move. he knew what he wanted. It was very simple. And then years later, we had a really nice pointer bitch named Crook Ras Maud. And Cheryl, my wife, has not been in the ring very often in her life, but I had something to do. I couldn't go to these shows in Maryland. And Billy Kendrick was judging, and it was, you know, 100-point major because Billy was judging everybody game. So I called a bunch of friends and said, keep an eye on Cheryl, get her all done about. And she did. And she walked in the ring like everybody else in line. And he went up and down the line. And poor Cheryl didn't. She goes to a lot of shows. She knows what to do, but she hasn't been in the ring much. And Billy called her out to the middle of the ring and just made her stand in the middle of the ring all by herself. And he went and judged them all. And from the middle of the ring, he moved her down and back. And he said, if you're wondering, this is the only pointer I have. So she goes winner's bitch, and she ended up winning the breed. But he wanted to make it a point that he could do whatever he wanted. You know, he was that good.
That brings me to my next question almost. That rolls right into it.
And by the way, you're the next Billy Kendrick, just so you know.
Yeah.
That's what Eddie and I have decided. Eddie Zook and I have decided.
Well, thanks. Oh, you lost me now. Okay.
You're fun of that.
Today's judging process, what do you think of that? Do you have any changes, any advice, the process of these judges being approved or applying?
How much time do we have? well, I think it starts, it's an interesting, and I've written about it, I write for Canine Chronicle now, and I've written about it a few times, and I really enjoy it. It starts with the number of dog shows we have. There's so many. And, you know, the gas crisis in the 70s, all of a sudden we had these clusters and circuits, so you didn't have to drive far. and it became the norm. And then there were 5 and 6 shows on one day, or on one weekend. And when the number of shows dramatically increased, it's just by almost a factor of 2 over the years. The entry sizes, of course, shrunk per show. That were just more shows, fewer entries. That's the way it worked. And you all of a sudden had this rush for judges. We needed them. But no one could afford, when they have an 800-dog show or a 600-dog show, that used to be a 3,000-dog show, no one can afford to hire a bunch of breeder judges and provisionals like we used to do. So you need a judge that can do 3 groups to make it financially feasible.
Sure.
So all of a sudden, you're in the position to rush people through. And then on the other side of the coin, because you have this system, you can't just give the guys and women all the, I mean, there's certain people that you just said, by the way, here's your all-breed ticket, have a nice day. It shouldn't have to. So we had that juxtaposition of people flying all over the country. And now it comes down to, do you have the time and money to attend 32 seminars, whatever it is for sporting group, it used to be 26. There's a new one every day, it seems. Do you have the money to go to 26, 32, 50 seminars to get a group or two? And the time? You have to fly all over the country to do this. And that's a, you know, that's a big burden for a judge. And to be able to pull, and I think the AKC did a good job of scheduling them, trying to condense them and put them together. But just because you took a seminar, you know, we've all been in them with, there's 20 people. And when I've given seminars, you get a bunch of people in the room, and the first 10 minutes, you know, the 2 get it, and the others don't care, and they just want a certificate. So I don't know what you do about it, with the exception of having fewer shows, because that would give the clubs opportunities to not have to hire someone who can judge every day for 5 days.
Yeah.
There's still the opportunity, though, for those people who really care to go find breed mentors. You know, go find the people who are winning and ask them about their breed, not just to write it down for an exam or an application, to really learn about the essence of that breed, the temperament, the character. I want to know everything. I want to know health problems, temperament, I want to know everything. And, you know, even if you're driving them crazy and if they don't like it, go to the next one, because there's people out there who do like to share. And I think it's something you have to take on by yourself. And if you think you can do it by reading a breed standard and going to a seminar, not even close.
I wrote an article years ago, and was dog show judge needed, no experience necessary. And it was basically about taking a book of the sporting dog standards into a coffee shop like Tim Hortons, finding a student and saying, here, study this for an hour, you're going to write a test. And they, most of them would pass without even seeing a dog.
Right. That's right. Yeah. We had an artist at the AKC that we hired. I think it was the magazine department that did it. They gave him, he'd never seen a Clumber Spaniel, obviously not many people have. They gave him the standard and said, draw a Clumber Spaniel. And it was hysterical. I mean, the thing was 40 miles long. It looked like a caricature of a Clumber. So unless you've seen them.
Yeah, that mind's up again. Yeah.
I was struggling with Chesapeake Bay Retrievers very early in my life. And I was at Elliot Weiss's house, and he and Ellen had, at the time, his wife Ellen had a bunch of Chessies in the backyard, and we're sitting at the kitchen table, and we're talking about Chesapeake Bay Retrievers, and I really wanted to learn that one more thing. And all of a sudden I looked in the yard, and there was a really beautiful bitch. I said, that's it. That's filling my eye right there. And he said, you've got it. If I hadn't seen that bitch on that day, I would have struggled for a while. If you haven't seen a good one, not a top winning one.
No, exactly.
A good one, a really good one. It's hard to get the breed. And when you see people who never had a good one get their license in a certain breed, you just wonder how they're ever going to sort through.
I believe that.
You can get by. You can get by. You send them down and back if they're halfway sound and they're in coat and they've been advertised enough. You can join the bandwagon. I mean, you don't have to know anything to put up the top winning dogs, right? But watch those people judge the classes.
Yeah.
Watch them judge the classes and you'll see them struggle. And those are things that you can only learn by being around. And like Luke said, you know, we hung around to the end of the day. Now you're in the judging program is at 9:35 after two. You know, you get there at 9:40, you brush them, not in a nightgown or house coat. You brush them, quick, take them in, get your ribbon and go home. And no one's learning anything that way.
No, exactly.
The other thing I feel absolutely adamant about is if you don't learn the root breeds of a breed, really learn them, you're never going to know how to judge that breed. If you don't know about foxhounds and greyhounds and bloodhounds and terriers, the breeds that made up pointers, the breeds that were used to bring in infusions of certain talents and things they needed, abilities, you'd never know pointers. Because
good point.
When you're looking at a tuck-up, if it's a lot of skirting, if it's straight underline, there's too much hound blood in there still, and you'll see roundish bone with that and a longer ear with that. If it's got too much tuck-up and a little too much rise over the loin, you know, it's the greyhound infusion. And I'm not saying this is in that generation. It's generations ago. But it's still there. And if you don't know that for comparison, how are you going to compare it? How are you going to know the difference between the retrievers without knowing the outlines, the silhouettes of all the retrievers? You can't just judge Labradors without knowing Chessies and flat coats and the rest. So without that thirst, that desire, that passion, go learn about those breeds. Look at old art. Look at old photographs. Read histories. Go to the zoo and look at the conformation of some zoo animals, and you'll understand what shoulders are like in a giraffe. You know how many cervical vertebrae a giraffe has?
No, I don't.
Seven. Do you know how many a pug has?
No.
Seven. All mammals have seven. And by the way, the reason fronts are so difficult, you know, we all talk about, oh, we can put heads on, you know, put tail, we can't fix fronts. Fronts aren't connected to anything. We got these wonderful clavicles here. You know, we got these little collarbones. Dogs don't. So they're hanging their whole shoulder assembly, their whole front assembly on ligaments and tendons hung over the spine. So how important is it to have that center of gravity? How important is it in certain breeds, not all, of course, to have feet under the withers for a center of gravity and the correct upper arm length, the correct shoulder blade length, and the oblique way it sits into the body? Those are just hanging on by threads. Strong threads, but threads, not by a bone. So it's so important to get that level of anatomy and learn more about just your breed to tick off a box. And I just hope there's people with enough passion to do that. They can get assignments. You know, it's tough. It's going to be a long haul for many shows.
Yeah. I have another question for you along those lines again, because we've talked about breeders and judges. Do you have any advice for new handlers?
Well, it's going to be hard to find someone. First of all, I would suggest these days not to work for only one handler. Because as it is now, there's lots of specialists. And I can say this honestly, Will. There's very few who can show and trim a sheepdog, a terrier, a sporting dog like you can. We don't have people that can show every single breed and trim them. I think the McFaddens are there. And I think there's others. I don't want to discount people, but we used to have anybody, you know, you can go to trainer, you can go to anybody,
yeah,
and learn all those things. So unless you're going to specialize in one group and you're not going to really ever have the career you want, if you do that, you might want to work for a couple, not 20, but a couple. And when you do not expect money. That's ridiculous. How much they're going to pay me. Forsyth gave me my first check and said, you know what, kid? You should be paying me this for the education you're getting here. And it wasn't funny. He was right.
Yeah, honestly, I agree.
So to think you're going to go make money and then get in the ring and show all the specials and be famous in 2 years, it just isn't going to work that way. And you need to learn about first aid. You know, we all run into dogs that get sick on the road. Who are you going to call? We all knew what to do. We had a tack box full of what we needed too. So those are lessons that go beyond just winning. And it sounds old to say, pay your dues, pick up a lot of poop, but that's where you learn.
Oh, of course it is, in the trenches. Like
look at the guys who work for you, Will, they're doing so well. Adam and those guys, they know everything they need to know about putting together a complete pack to show a dog. It takes that kind of dedication.
I love watching them. I'm always proud when they do well.
Yeah, they should be.
Any regrets in the sport of dogs?
Well, it's hard to say you have regrets when, I mean, I've been able to make my entire living. When I worked on Wall Street, I worked for a guy who was in our kennel club who have Labradors. Who else is going to hire me on Wall Street? I wanted to learn about money because I was making some, so I thought that was a way to do it. Every job I had in my life had to do with purebred dogs. That's just an incredible thing to be fortunate and thankful for. So regrets, it's hard to say. I'm thrilled that my son is interested and my daughter just loves her beagle. Son's got a pointer, you know, that fourth generation thing's kind of cool. They're not interested in showing, but they sure love their dogs. And Brody's kind of interested.
He visited me at shows. Yeah, he liked going to them, watching.
So. Yeah, and Brody was the co-owner of Miss P for a while. So there you go. He's on, you know, he's on a good.
I ended with you and watched her show when we first started her. It was always.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. We drove up to Canada and see your
show. So
by the way, can we tell a story about how I got on her?
Sure, if you want to.
I hate to be another Doug story, but it's a pretty good one. Is it okay? Seriously?
I don't see why not.
It cost me a lot of money to play a practical joke, but Will had brought Miss P down. She's very young in the classes to Kalamazoo for me to show. It's nearby my house. And of course, I fell in love with her. And we always have a really friendly competition with Doug. You know, I mean, it's truly because we're that good of friends that you can do this stuff. But we thought it would be funny to let it get to Doug that I had just bought her and I was going to be her backer and Will was going to show it. Because poor Doug he'd get a little unglued about having to run up against that wall every weekend for a few years. And although he's certainly done fine on his own. But so we were kidding. And we did what everybody should do when you want something to spread to the show. You find Mark Bettis. And I love Mark. He's a brother. I love him to death. But, you know, he's good. He was in on the show, but he went and told everybody that Kavanaugh was buying this beagle for Wayne and for Will and we're going to take off with this thing. And Doug came unglued. And it was so much fun to watch his head turn red from here up, you know. And then we thought, the next day, I think, Will said, well, how about we, you know, maybe we should really do this. So we did, and it was great fun. Certainly more fun than certainly Lori Cranemar, the breeder of this bitch, gets all the credit. And then Eddie did an amazing job coming on board. And, of course, we got the best handler in the world. But years later, he said to me, you know, that was pretty funny what you did there. And he said, it's even funnier that I know that I got to cost you a couple hundred grand. And it wasn't a couple hundred grand. We did it the old school way. So we all got our jokes on each other on that one. But it was a good time. It was a real good time.
I have one last question for you. In today's world right now, where our stoppage, everything's stopped. The world has stopped, it seems. Seems like we're all living I Am Legend. Where do you see dog shows going after this, after we hope this all straightens out?
I think they'll bounce back, and I don't think it's going to take too long. The people are passionate that do this sport. They're raring to go, get back in to the sport. I worry about the handlers being able to stay solvent during this time so they can get back in the wagon and go to the shows and get it done. But I do think we'll come back fine. It's like the stock market. You know, when it dips this sharply, it rises this sharply. It could take a while. It may, unfortunately, some of the smaller clubs may fold. If there's a silver lining, maybe we'll have fewer clubs, fewer shows. And maybe that'll sort of get back to a more reasonable spread of the number of shows. With that said, those small shows in the middle of Nebraska that people can't get, you know, a lot of people can't get to, they deserve a place in this world because that's all the people have in that area. So is there a way we can keep them solvent by putting on some kind of show until they can, maybe not even a champion show, until they get their legs? But I do have, you know, we've been through a lot in the sport. My dad used to tell me about going to Philadelphia on a weekend, and half the gentry was dead from distemper the next day when they went to Atlantic City. You know, we forget all those things we've been through. And most important, I talked to my mom about this. She'll be 99 in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And she's sharp as a tack, sharp as a tack. And all she can say is,
"He's winning."
All she can say is, "Seriously, you think this is going to set dog shows back? I went through depression, you wimp. Buck up. It's not like we're sending you to war or anything. You just have to hang home for a couple months and get it back together and go show your dogs." Yeah. So, you know, I like her spirit. And I think that I do think that we've got to resolve. We're going to need to work together. The AKC, the clubs, the handlers, the breeders, they're going to need to work together. But I do think it'll come back and maybe even better than ever.
Yeah, maybe it'll be like a giant reset button for us.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
That's my
hope. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. That's my hope.
That is my hope. We'll see. When I was doing television, and I love the interview parts, and this was for, might have been NBC Sports, but it was California, Santa Barbara Show, and Terry Thorne was doing Best in Show. And a lovely guy, and I knew him from Crufts, and we got along well. And there was a attractive young woman, showing a Australian Shepherd who was dressed appropriately, only if you knew that, you know, a man was going to be judging. And they were just recognized in America, Australian Shepherds, that year. They didn't have them in England at all, this recognized breed. So, of course, Terry gives her Best in Show. My first question is this the best Australian Shepherd you've ever seen? And, of course, all I could say was, it's the only one I've ever seen. And then at Crufts that same year, I was back and I was doing Crufts, and the Clumber that went Best in Show, I can't think of his name, is a great dog. Who ended up just being a pub dog right after the show. It was an Irish guy showing him. And you know, that lovely English, it's kind of like just this great Ford Chevy battle between England and Ireland, and they like to rib each other. And this dog comes over from Ireland and wins the group and Best in Show at Crufts. So I interview the guy and I said, he's his owner handler, you know, and I said, this must be the most exciting one of your life. And in his perfect Irish sensibility, he looks and goes, no, I went second in the group at the St. Patrick's Day show a couple months ago. That was a big one. The Irish shows are better than this silly crap show. Perfect. You know, so I had a lot of fun with those interviews, but we learned a lot too. You know, you'd ask some of these questions, you learn a lot from these guys. But man, there was a million of them. I worked for, they used to give me a bunch of different co-hosts. Some of them were brilliant, like Ron Reagan. Others were not so much. And I had one who, I had two Miss Americas, but this one was especially interesting. And we were live. I think it was the Rose City shows, Patty Strand's great shows out there. And the Black and Tan Coonhound. So I said, we're doing groups. And I said, this is the Black and Tan Coonhound. And I won't mention her name, but I turned to her and said, and she said, oh, what colors do they come in? So I, as straight face as I could, I went, well, they come in black and tan. I had some real winners. It reminded me of Best in Show. I get those co-hosts, you know. We had one who couldn't say her own name. She just got married, and she'd say, and my name is Donna Deverona, and that's her real name. And she would say Donna Deverina, and I'd say, no, that's not quite your name. Let's cut and do it over again. So I had some great Miss Americas and to work with, an Olympic athlete. I had some great ones too. But the worst was at Crufts. They brought a woman over from America. She was fairly she had a lot of TV exposure on a popular show, I'd say that. Very attractive. And at Crufts, the lobby of the hotel is just a beehive of activity and friendships and conversation. So no one knew her, but she showed up, and it didn't take her long to start holding court. And every English businessman on a trip or everybody else was gathering around the circle, and she was getting good and hammered on her bottle of wine. And I said, you know, we got a live American interview to do. A radio show back in America at 1 a.m. their time. So I'm going to bed, and I'm going to, you know, I'll set my alarm and we'll wake up. And the sound guy could only do it in my room because he had no other place that was going to be quiet enough. So she had to come up to my room. It's just me, sound guy, camera guy for backups, and her. And she knocks on the door, and she's hammered. She's got a bottle of wine, and she sits down on the bed, and it's just a little tiny room. It's a twin bed. There's no place to sit. And the guy with the sound, and they're all crammed in there. And the first question that it might have been Steve Dale asked her is, how are you doing today? And she said, how am I? And my kids and my wife are watching back home. How you doing today? And she says, how am I doing? I'm in bed with Wayne Kavanaugh, and I've got a bottle of wine. I'm doing great. No, it's not. It's not like that, honey. It's just not like that. There was another Miss America I worked with that we had to carry back to a room one night. So now, not to say, and I want to make it clear, I've worked some brilliant Miss Americas, but I've had a couple that made Best in Show look very real. The movie Best in Show looked very real. Good times.
Okay. Well, thanks, Wayne. This has been a great time. You're an idol of mine, so I always say.
You of mine, young William.
I say, when I grow up, I want to be Wayne Kavanaugh.
Well, we didn't get to the guitars and the cars and the tiny house and all the other fun stuff. You'll have to do another show on non-dog stuff just to bore everybody.
Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate this. And yep. Give Cheryl my love and Haley and Brody and all the dogs. We didn't Absolutely. See Haley, and after that, we saw his head when I was talking to you earlier. Where is he? Is he there?
He's sound asleep in the other room. He's really letting me down. He's had it with me for the day. And by the way, happy birthday, Will.
Oh, thanks.
Love you, brother.
I love you. Time.
And do all well right. with this. Do well with this. I like them.
No, I really enjoy doing them. All right. I'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
Take care, bud. We'll see you. Happy birthday.
Thanks.
Told you, lived up to his expectations. He's what a hell of an interview. I could have gone on forever. I could have listened to Wayne just talk all day. Anyway, if you like what we're doing here, make sure you press like, share, and subscribe. And go into Will Alexander's Dog Show Tips and take a look at all our other videos. And there'll be a whole library full of. We have Luke's interview. We have the new wake-up call. We have all those training videos as well. So like, share, and subscribe. And keep Will in the lifestyle he's grown accustomed to.